Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett. Welcome to another edition of Speaking of Reliability. I'm here with Chris Stoppelman. Hey, Chris, how's it going?
Hey, good, Adam. How are you?
Good. So we were thinking of talking a little bit more about the difference between quality and reliability, and then, of course, all the things around that with regard to how they interact with each other or how they affect a program.
Yeah, well, what is the difference between quality and reliability? I get asked that question, especially as I start a new job sometimes, and it's a new role in the organization. People are confused. What's the difference between you? Aren't you just another quality engineer?
Yeah.
I'm like, no, not really. So what is the difference? How do you explain that? You know, how do you explain how that works? And I mean, there's a definition of there are lots of definitions for quality and reliability out there.
Yeah, like, there are.
You know, quality being the fitness for use, being one definition, and reliability, to say it very, very succinct, is, you know, quality over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's one way of describing it.
I think I tend to describe it like this if I had to do it very quickly, is that reliability is about the application of specific tools and methods during the product development process to make a more reliable product. Quality is about very much about the manufacturing and implementation in the field of monitoring and improving in that phase. So I almost separate them out by product phase.
Okay, that's interesting, because I would go back and say, well, reliability, you have the quality is the initial impression when you first deliver your product, and then the reliability is, you know, over time, do you keep that? And yes, it is created in the initial phases of the product development process. You know, it's designed in.
Yep. So it sounds like mine was in the context of the roles. So like you were saying, you know, if they ask you what is a reliability engineer to do versus a quality engineer, I guess in my mind then the roles I parse out that their major contributions are in different product development phases.
Yeah.
But a lot of people would disagree with that, I'm sure.
So what does this look like in practice? Where have I seen overlap between quality and reliability? And I've been in some quality roles and also in reliability roles, and I see there's certain overlap.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about field failures, for example, I would think that the monitoring of field failures and collecting that data is more of a quality engineering role. And then what happens with that data in terms of analysis, making prediction for warranty allocation or calculating reliability from that, that would then fall over into the reliability engineer's lab.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see a lot of shared, yeah, in that latter part of the analysis. But yeah, but as you said, the, you know, kind of that fits my definition that the quality is very much about monitoring and, you know, and collecting and correctly beginning to parse out that information. Because I feel like if you look in the quality engineer's toolbox, they really are very much around the, you know, monitoring and, you know, setting up different things that will trigger or, you know, like CPK charts, right? Like they're looking to collect data, monitor it, and then to trigger actions, you know, based on trends. So that's very much on the manufacturing and, you know, field side. When I look at the reliability engineer's toolbox, a lot of them are testing methods that provide feedback or measurement during product development, you know, and that there's different tools that follow along the different steps of product maturity. You know, you can use Hall testing very early on, even before a product's done, with if you have a subset that functions, and to just break it a bunch of different ways. And the only value that information has is to the designer. You know, this is how it broke. Does that help you at all? So that's, you know, I kind of feel like if I look at the toolboxes for both of those disciplines, that backs up a little bit of that the significance of their the core of their contribution are at these different product development phases, and they do over and then of course they overlap a lot. There's not a clear partition between the two.
Yeah, I would agree with how you describe it there. And what I struggle with is, you know, if you're manufacturing a product somewhere, either your own company does it or you outsource it, unless you're in the service industry. So you're manufacturing a product, and statistical process control is just a big thing for me within the manufacturing process. So your process stays in control, or you know when it's not in control and you need to have corrective actions. And yes, that is a quality engineering role, but it affects reliability so much because once your manufacturing process is out of control, that's when you start seeing what we call the infant mortality failures in the field. You have manufacturing defects that cause your reliability issues early on in the product life.
Yeah.
And so I have a hard time staying away as a reliability engineer, staying away from the SPC charts and the vendor quality. I want to, again, roll up my sleeves there and dive in and make sure that we have, you know, or our vendors have good process control in place and work side by side with the quality engineers there. And hopefully not step on their toes too much.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a very important thing, though, is that it shouldn't be step on their toes. It should be this kind of team collaboration thing. You know, as you're describing, it's for them to generate those CPK charts and everything, there has to be an audience for them, right? And some of that audience is the reliability engineering. But and then there's this sense of, you know, one of my earlier first mentors said quality and reliability are kissing cousins. You know, that overlap is so important to acknowledge, and it's probably really critical for the departments to acknowledge that so that you get that really great collaboration, you know, for all those parts where these really the other group can be the customer of the tools that we're talking about.
Yeah, and I like that. I hadn't thought of it that way, being the audience for those quality charts. So that's a very good way of describing it.
Yeah, so it's kind of neat. So, I mean, I wonder what, you know, it's interesting because you also described it from the product perspective too, from actually the customer perspective, really, how they would define quality and reliability. And that's, you know, I have heard that definition that reliability is quality over time. That definition's never grabbed me. You know, I kind of was like, I'm like, well, what does that mean exactly? But, you know, as you explained it there in that one case where quality is their first impression, almost as a product feature, right? What's the quality of the product? And then the reliability is, you know, over time, how consistent it is. So it sounds like it's almost within that definition that the difference is reliability's consistency.
Yeah, and maybe some people think this is funny and hope I'm not offending anybody. Being German, growing up in Germany, I would think that German cars have a very high quality, the way they build things, tolerances. You know, when you open and close the door, you know, it just makes a different noise or gives you a different feeling of quality than maybe some other cars. But what am I driving? I'm driving Japanese cars. And why is that? Because I think they're going to be more reliable. I have to go see the shop less, and it could be small issues. You know, it could be electronic issues that crop up, but I don't want to have my car. I don't want to have to take my car to the shop instead of going to work, you know,
That's so interesting. Yeah. That's actually a perfect, I think, real life description of what you're saying. And one that anybody can relate to. And I don't know if you know, I'm a huge car guy. I bought my first car before I had my driver's license, and cars are always a analogy I go to, and, you know, something that I'm always designing or building something with cars at home. And, you know, it's funny you say German and Japanese, because I think that's such an interesting progression. And especially if you look at, you know, brands like Mercedes, where if you go back to the 1980s, a Mercedes was it. That was the car. And it wasn't only high quality, it would be high quality forever. You know, people would have a 1980s or earlier Mercedes or 70s for 20 something years, and it would work perfectly. And I see Mercedes as the opposite now, and I can only assume that they intentionally made the shift. But, if you look at a good indicator of a Mercedes and that within that, you know, that metric now is there'll be a $100,000 Mercedes that's 4 years old and it'll be worth $25,000. I mean, its value will have plummeted. And it's because of exactly what you said, that there'll just be constant, chronic, small, weird electrical or gadget problems after that 4 year, you know, 3 or 4 year mark. And I almost think that Mercedes must have maybe did that on purpose because they realized that the customers, there was a need, there was a market for them to go to where they offer the latest, the greatest, the most amazing new features, and the, you know, which effectively could be perceived as high quality. And but a lot of those customers who want that also don't keep cars very long. They don't keep cars for 10 years or 20 years. They lease them for 3 years and get rid of them and get the next new latest greatest one, which that's the only way you can stay on the cutting edge. So there, you know, and Mercedes doesn't make money off the third or fourth owner. So I almost wonder if that they made that trade consciously, you know, to include things that aren't totally mature, but will, you know, be perceived of high quality.
I hope that they made it consciously, because I've also seen companies that get complacent with success
and say, true.
Hey, we've got the best quality here. Nobody can touch us, even, you know, even like low cost, high volume manufacturers cannot outdo us because our customers want this quality or something. You know, it starts biting them because they didn't gauge the market right. You know, just having a big brand name doesn't ensure success in the long term.
Well, look at Hyundai, right? Hyundai was considered, you know, maybe 15 years ago, kind of like the bottom end economy, you know, brand. And if, you know, Hyundai had ever said, or anybody said Hyundai was going to start going after Mercedes, you know, everybody'd laugh hysterically. Well, nobody's laughing anymore. If you look at the, you know, the Genesis, Hyundai's starting to experiment with the luxury market. And the Genesis car, which is now their flagship, it's the four-door sedan, it clearly went directly after the, you know, Mercedes four-door sedans. And for like half the price, you almost get the same car. It's even their grill they made look like it. You know, they didn't hide it at all who they were targeting. And so all of a sudden, for under $30,000, you have something that almost is, you know, really the, you know, the same functionality, features, performance of a car that's two or three times more, depending on which Mercedes model you get. And the hysterical part is that the Hyundai will consistently perform that way much longer. You know, it has a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty, and it lives up to it. Whereas the Mercedes, as we said, we know 4 or 5 years down the road, you're going to go crazy. And it's, you know, so that's kind of interesting. Like you said, that could be complacency. And, you know, and it's also funny we're talking about it because right now I just recently had an experience is I have my fun sports cars and stuff, but my favorite car right now, my daily driver, is my 2014 Honda Crosstour. And I've had Hondas and Acuras always. And this was the replacement for my Acura RL. I basically wanted an Acura station wagon kind of thing, right? The Honda Crosstour is amazing. I love it. And somebody hit my car, you know, small fender bender kind of thing. So instead of grabbing a rental car, I grabbed one of my mother-in-law's cars, and she has a 2014 Mercedes GLK. So it's like the small Mercedes SUV. Oh my God, I couldn't wait to get rid of that thing. I hated it. It had so many cockamamie gadgets and the interfaces, and it was always trying to outthink me. And I was so frustrated with how hard they tried to make it so high tech. It would do things like I couldn't figure, like when I got rid of it, I still couldn't figure out things. I couldn't figure out how to put on the high beams. And it turns out after researching it that it doesn't allow you to put on the high beams if you're going under 35 miles an hour. So the roads to my house where I want it, I can't do it unless I put it on. I take it off auto and I put it on manual headlights. Like all these things, the backup camera doesn't go on unless the radio's on. I'm not kidding. And that's the way it actually is, because turning on the radio turns on the control system and the control system. So there's no backup camera unless you, like, there's just all these things. I'm like, guys, are you serious? And it even almost really did something dangerous. If you, so like my Honda, if I am starting to go over the center line or, you know, it gives me a beeping noise to let me know. And Mercedes took it much farther with this generation where it has a vibration in the steering wheel. And it, you know, so you feel the vibration almost like a rumble strip. It's like, oh, that's pretty cool. Which can also be annoying because sometimes roads are very narrow and the lines are very narrow. So it's kind of now more annoying. And I couldn't find a way to turn it off. Whereas the Honda has a button right on the dash, right by your knee. You can turn it off if you like, if you say, I don't want this indication for whatever reason. Now, here's where it got really dicey, is it also will, if you do it like two or three times in a row, it will start to put on the brakes when you go over a line. So it doesn't just give the vibration, it actually pumps the brakes a little bit. And I was driving down a small backcountry road, and there was a motorcycle behind me. And the car started doing the vibration thing, and then it started doing the pumping brake thing. And I'm like, I know it's a narrow road, but I'm like, I'm not going over the lines. And it kept doing it over and over again. And the motorcycle behind me is closing distance on me, and he must be thinking, what the hell am I doing? And I'm also wondering at this time, does it put on the brake lights when it does this? Maybe he's seeing me brake, but there's no brake lights as well. I don't know. And what I finally figured out was happening was there were power lines that were relatively low power lines, and the shadow was on the road right by the edge by the line. And as you know, power line shadows are, you know, they look like a wave. So I think it was picking that up as the line and was continuously pumping my brakes while I was driving. I was so glad to get rid of this car. I can't tell you.
So that's a good example of an edge case where the engineers didn't take this effect into account, right?
Right.
They were looking for a line, but they were seeing a shadow, not a line painted on the road.
Right. But now they had, but by having the pumping brake thing, you know, so they were trying to take this technology to this level. The Honda addressed it by having a button on the dash. I can get rid of it if I don't want it. And they also probably, you know, they weren't trying to be the latest and greatest. They were putting on features that were known to be proven and reliable, and the effect of maybe an issue wouldn't be a major drive, you know, a major experience for the driver. So they didn't include the pumping the brake thing. I'm sure they could have included that feature, but they're going to wait till that technology gets worked out, right, before they do it. Whereas Mercedes was probably so eager to advertise, you know, that it will pump the brakes or whatever, it wasn't mature, and it ended up being something I didn't like. So yeah, two different strategies. So I'll probably always own some Honda or Acura or Toyota. I was so happy to get my stupid Crosstour back. I love that thing.
Yeah, and it depends on the user, right? I mean, sometimes somebody wants that cutting edge latest,
yeah,
like a self-driving Tesla or you know, like a Mercedes that has all these features. And you got to give them credit for being the first one to bring it to the market, because somebody has to.
Yep.
And I think by bringing these very advanced technologies to the market, you know, they're bringing it into the mainstream. You know, that's when then production volumes go up, cost comes down for these systems. And in the end, everybody benefits from this technology now that it's cheaper and available. We've all benefited from airbags and ABS systems that at some point in time, you know, weren't as reliable as they are right now when they were first introduced.
Yeah. So we'll give Mercedes the benefit of the doubt, and we'll say that they know what market they're going for, a specific type of customer that wants the latest and greatest, even if it's not fully mature. It's worth it to them to have it and to pay the premium for it. And Honda's going for the market of the customer that wants cost is a big deal, and also reliability is their number one. So they're willing to have less features by waiting for technology to, you know, have to go through more cycles of maturity before they're incorporated. And that's, and I guess it's clear which side that I actually fall into.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't like it when gadgets outthink me. I like to be in control of what I want to achieve at a certain point in time.
Yeah. Or I love Honda's. It's a big button on the dash that turns it off. You know, it's just right there. And, you know, so if I'm driving and yeah, it's like they gave me the opportunity to be like, this technology is annoying me. And so totally different experience. That was interesting.
Yeah. I had something similar happen to me where I rented a Mercedes in Germany, and we were going through a small town, and there was a small stone bridge we had to go over. The road was narrow and there was another car coming, and we could just barely squeeze by with the mirrors almost touching, the side of the car almost touching the side of the stone bridge. And the car just kept beeping at me because the proximity sensors were going off all around. And I'm thinking, that's not helping me steer here and concentrate. It's distracting. And I, in that situation, you can't start looking for the off button or go through a scroll down menu and find it and disable this particular function. So it's nice to have that button that turns it all off right in front of you.
Yep. Definitely. Well, good. All right. Well, that's great. We covered some good stuff there. So, Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. And to our listeners, if you would like to comment, we'd love to see your feedback, and we'll talk with you again soon. Thanks again, Chris.
Yeah. Thank you, Adam. My pleasure.
Take care.
You too.
Hi there. It's Fred here. Do you or those around you use MTBF? If so, I have to ask you why. Check out my short book, The Reliability Metric, a quick and valuable improvement over MTBF. In it, you will find details on how just poor metric MTBF is for reliability, and specifics on what you should do instead. A useful reliability metric will help you and your team make better decisions. To find out more and to get a copy, go to ascendoreliability.com/go/metric. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.